I thought that to start off this morning, do something that we haven't done, at least not recently, which is I would read you two Hasidic takes on the stories that we've just been looking at before I get to today's sort of topic. One is if you recall when, this is from Rabbi Tzvi Leshem, it's called Redemptions, Hasidic Essays on the Parsha and the Festivals. And if you recall when Jacob comes to Isaac to steal the birthright, Isaac says famously, the hands are the hands of Esau, the voice is the voice of Jacob, right? And that has been used throughout Jewish history in different ways. That is, you know, when the ruling parties speak kindly but act cruelly, they say the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. But here's a Hasidic take on that, which is a different way of approaching the Parsha and is worth quoting. From this we can learn, that is, the voice of Yaakov in the hands of Esau, that even Yaakov, who spent his time studying Torah and engaging in spiritual pursuits, occasionally had to use his hands to work in the physical area. However, going against his intrinsic nature was very difficult. The Meshiloach writes that when he fled to Laban's home, Yaakov became depressed because he was forced to leave Israel, where his ancestors spent most of their lives in pursuit of the spiritual, and enter the material diaspora. Right? This is a completely different take on what we've seen. He's leaving the world of spirit and he's entering the world. Remember, with Laban, he starts to make a living. Well, you may not remember, we haven't gotten to that yet, but when he comes to Laban, he starts to make a living. Yaakov may have been unaware of the long-term significance of his journey, but as the Sfat Emet says, the trip was a preparation and guidance for future exile, that we will be able to correct ourselves even outside of Israel, right? Jacob is showing later generations that even outside of Israel, there's important work to be done. But exactly why did Yaakov have to leave Israel? Rabbi Simcha Bunim of Psicha said, the main reason was to gather, bless you, positive understandings and traits and bring them to holiness. For as long as a good trait is held by them, it is in exile. Them refers primarily to Rachel and Leah, those holy sparks that had fallen into the evil domain of Laban and awaited Yaakov to redeem them. Right? Rachel and Leah are holy sparks. They had holy sparks in them, but they were in Laban's house. So they have to be redeemed. Yaakov goes there to redeem those holy sparks, to get them out of Laban's house, to rescue them, so to speak, and to bring them into holiness. Thus, the Zohar states that Rachel represents the revealed world of Malchut, and Leah symbolizes the hidden world of Binah, both Sfirot. It's complicated. For those of you who are familiar with this, these are both attributes of God, okay? I'm not going to go into too much detail. There are two different approaches to the service of God that Yaakov brings to Israel. Before he left for Israel, the angels returned to heaven, ascending the ladder of his dream. New angels of exile approach him. In between, Yaakov lives with Laban and engages with general culture. I'm skipping a little bit. Therefore, while some aspects of foreign Western culture have intrinsic value and may enhance our avodat Hashem, that service of God, if we use them carefully, others are intrinsically evil or fraught with grave danger if used unwisely. Okay? So that's a very different take on Yaakov's journey, but one that has echoes in the Jewish tradition and is quite a beautiful and consistent one if you think about it, right? Yaakov leaves Israel because there are sparks of holiness in the diaspora that he has to redeem. Diaspora culture has those sparks of holiness, but a lot of it is just rotten. Okay, and then I'm going to give you one more. I thought I'd read this one as well. Another Hasidic take, and then we're going to get to the question of love. Spiritual ascent. Fleeing from Esav, Yaakov reaches Beit El, future home of the temple, and Davin's Ma'ariv, right? This isn't everybody's take, but this is his take. His prayer experience is called Pigiyah, touching. And according to Rav Kook, it represents the deepest kind of prayer, leading to a prophetic experience. Yaakov sleeps, dreaming of the heaven, and so on and so forth. The Midrash has various interpretations of the significance of the dream. Okay, we've talked about, he lists some, but they're ones we've talked about. Based on the Zohar, the Kuntres, and so on and so forth, and the latter is a symbol of prayer. During morning prayers, we ascend higher and higher from one world to the next, ultimately reaching Atzilut, which is a high level of the Sefirot, when we daven the Amidah. Only then are we able to descend back to our world, bringing with us the divine influx. The Beit Aharon also views the latter as representing man himself. One must be moderate, neither raising oneself too high nor lowering oneself too much. Clearly, the latter also represents our ability to reach spiritual heights while remaining firmly rooted in earthly physicality. Before sleeping, Yaakov made a pillow out of stone. According to Rashi, many stones competed to become one. The Me'or Enayim brings two explanations. First, each stone is one of the 12 tribes, 12 stones, 12 tribes, each offering unique approach to Avodat Hashem. God accepts all of them, for all of them are the words of the living God. Additionally, they represent the 22 letters of the alphabet. Vayishkav, which means and he lay, equals 22. Kav, he laid, there are 22. These letters are building blocks of the prayers that help us ascend the ladder to heaven, to cleave to Hashem. Let us all ascend, mindful of the warning that the higher one climbs, the more dangerous it is to fall. Hold on tight. So those are two quite different, but also beautiful and meaningful interpretations of what it is that we've already looked at. Okay. Now, this morning we're talking about love. And we do that because Jacob, almost immediately in chapter 29, when he sees Rachel, falls in love. Or at least he appears to. He certainly, the moment he sees her, he kisses her. This is not what happened before. Not only does he kiss her, but he also does something else that is characteristic of love, which is, let's look at the beginning, and then I'll... chapter 29 in Genesis. Jacob resumed his journey and came to the land of the Easterners, okay? B'nai Kedem, that really is literally the children of the East. Before his eyes was a well in the open. Three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for the flocks were watered from the well. The stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the stone would be rolled from the mouth of the well and the sheep watered. Then stone would be put back in its place in the mouth of the well. Jacob said, my friends, where are you from? We'll come back to this. They said, we're from Haran. He said, do you know Lavan, the son of Nahor? They said, we do. He said, is he well? They answered, yes, he is. There's his daughter Rachel coming to the flock. He said, it's still broad daylight, too early to round up the animals, water the flock and take them to pasture. They said, we can't until all the flocks are rounded up. The stone is rolled off the mouth of the water and we water the sheep. While he was still speaking with them, and we'll come back to that dialogue later, maybe not today, Rachel came with her father's flocks, for she was a shepherdess. And when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Laban, and the flock of his uncle Jacob, Jacob went and rolled the stone off the mouth of the well and watered the flock of his uncle Laban. Jacob kissed Rachel and broke into tears. Okay. Now, first of all, the first indication that he is impressed by Rachel is what? That this stone, which is explicitly, we're told, is a large stone. Remember, go back to verse 2. The stone on the mouth of the well was large. Okay? Evan gedola al pi habe'er. Why do they tell us that? Because Jacob is about to move it single-handedly. In other words, what's the best way to put this? Those of you who remember back to high school or college, right? How much better did the boys play when the girls were watching, right? That's what's going on here. Jacob sees Rachel and says, I can move that stone, right? This is the kind of thing that men still do into adulthood, which is why they ruin their backs, right? I can do that, watch me. And then all of a sudden, you can't do that anymore. You just thought you could. And then he goes up and kisses Rachel and breaks into tears. Now, unless he's completely false, right? There's something very powerful going on here. And this raises the interesting question that Leon Cass raises in his book. This is the way he talks about it. This is how he asks the question. The question is this: is falling and being in love good for piety. In other words, Jacob is the first person we see fall in love. Is that good? Because we just saw him have a dream of God. Is this going to increase his piety or decrease his piety? We seek especially to grasp the connection, if any, between Jacob as lover and Jacob as Israel. We've not seen a man act this way, right? In fact, Abraham, you know, all of a sudden, when they're about to go into Egypt, he says to Sarah, you know what? You're really pretty. Well, they've been married for years, right? And Abraham suddenly notices this. Jacob is not that way. Jacob is the first lover that we've really seen. And so it makes sense to ask, what is the nature of love in the Bible? And is love good or bad? And is love even real and lasting? And in order to give you both sides of this, I mean, it's not directly relevant, but they're two of my favorite poems. And it's the only time that I know of, although I'm sure there are others, where one poet reaches across time to another to answer his question. Walter Raleigh, who lived after Christopher Marlowe, right? Christopher Marlowe wrote a poem, A Passionate Shepherd to His Love, and years later, after Marlowe had died, Raleigh wrote the answer, okay? So I've always loved these poems, so I brought them to read to you, and here are the two sides. This is what Marlowe wrote. It's called The Passionate Shepherd to His Love, and you may, if you know anything about English poetry, you may at least recognize the first line because it's a famous one. Come live with me and be my love. This is from the 16th century, by the way. It was written about 1590, probably. Come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove that hills and valleys, dales and fields, and all the craggy mountains yields. And we will sit upon the rocks and see the shepherds feed their flocks by shallow rivers to whose falls melodious birds sing madrigals. And I will make thee beds of roses with a thousand fragrant posies, caps of flowers, and a kirtle embroidered all with leaves of myrtle, a gown made of the finest wool which from our pretty lambs we pull, fair-lined slippers for the cold with buckles of the purest gold, a belt of straw and ivory buds with coral clasps and amber studs. And if these pleasures may thee move, come live with me and be my love. The shepherd swains shall dance and sing for thy delight each May morning. If these delights thy mind may move, then live with me and be my love. Okay? But Raleigh writes back, and you would say, of course, sure, happy, be happy to be your love. Obviously a great guy. This is what he writes. And the first two lines are, actually the first verse is, if all the world and love were young and truth in every shepherd's tongue, these pretty pleasures might me move to live with thee and be thy love. Time drives the flocks from field to fold when rivers rage and rocks grow cold, and Philomel is the nightingale, okay? And Philomel becometh dumb. In other words, eventually nightingales stop singing. The rest complain of cares to come. The flowers fade and wanton fields to wayward winter reckoning yields. A honey tongue, in other words, beautiful speech, a heart of gall, but a bitter heart. In fancy, spring, but sorrows fall. Thy gowns, thy shirts, thy bed of roses, thy cap, thy kirtle, and thy posies soon break, soon wither, soon forgotten. In folly, that's foolishness, in folly ripe, in reason rotten. Thy belt of straw and ivy buds, thy coral clasp and amber studs, all these in me no means can move to come to thee and be thy love. But could youth last and love still breed, had joys no date, in other words, if joys never wore out, had joys no date, nor age, no need, then these delights my mind might move to live with thee and be thy love. It's quite beautiful because it actually embraces the two great themes of poetry. One is love and the other is death, right? Age and death, what the passionate shepherd sings about is youth and love. And what Raleigh answers him is age and death. Youth and love sound great, but I know that these things wear out, that winter follows spring, that all these promises are one thing, and you may even mean them for the moment, but, you know, the movie fades as soon as the couple gets together. So the same thing is true here. What happens to Jacob over time is very different from this first moment. And the question is a parallel question both to Jacob and Rachel as it is to Israel and God, which is not the initial falling in love, but the staying in love. not how Israel feels about God when God liberates them from Egypt, but how do they feel about God after wandering 40 years in the desert, right? Not how Jacob feels about God when he has this wonderful vision at Beit El, but how does he feel when he has to work 14 years to marry two women, and then his son gets kidnapped, and then he goes to Egypt. And remember what, at the end of his life, he says to Pharaoh. When Pharaoh asks him how old he is, he says, "Few and bitter are the years of my life," right? That's not the guy that we see kissing Rachel. So there is, I mean, the themes don't change, right? They're all the same, which is exactly why you read classic literature, because people have been there before you. And when I read Cass and he talked about the relationship of love and piety and how love lasts, it reminded me of those poems. How does Jacob manifest this? And what does it mean? Here's Benno Jacob's view of Jacob's. Benno Jacob was actually a very well-known rabbi in Germany, and he published his book right before 1938. Most of the copies were destroyed, but a few were smuggled out of Germany, and his children, both of whom were rabbis, translated it into English. He was a wonderful commentator on Genesis. And this is what he says about Jacob's stealing of the birthright and the frame of mind by which we have to see Jacob. "All human stratagems are vain. Jacob doesn't profit by having stolen the birthright. He's merely incurred the deadly hatred of his brother. So he, son and heir of a wealthy father, must flee from his parents' home in his native land. He's forced to do 20 years service abroad for a begrudging relative who cheats him." That's Laban, right? "He must earn everything by his own hard toil. Upon his return, he has to tremble for his life and humble himself deeply before his more powerful brother. Rebekah deceived herself by relying on the divine oracle. It referred not to persons, but to later peoples." In other words, when it said the older will serve the younger, it wasn't talking, he says, about Jacob and Esau. It was talking later about Israel and their neighbors. "A human blessing is only an empty wish if God doesn't confirm it. Isaac's fault was he wanted to bless Esau secretly, without the presence of brother and mother. So Rebekah might say, 'You want to conceal this from us? Then I'll see to it that you'll bless Jacob without noticing it.' The high value on which all parties set on the father's blessing is the only commendable part in this tragedy." So now think about it this way, which we haven't. Jacob, according to Benno Jacob, not only cheated his brother, but he got nothing out of it. Because he ran away, he's now got to work for Laban, who is a miserable SOB, right? And Laban's going to cheat him, and in the end, the truth is his children will inherit, but they would have inherited anyway. Jacob doesn't inherit the land, right? He gets buried back in Israel, but he never gets to really inherit the land. That takes a long time before Israel inherits the land. So when Jacob kisses Rachel and weeps, there's a lot for him to cry about. A lot for him to cry about. Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman, that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. And now here's the other point that I want to make before we talk about this episode in general. On hearing the news of his sister's son Jacob, Laban ran to greet him. He embraced him and kissed him and took him into his house. Okay? He told Laban all that had happened, and Laban said, "You are truly my bone and flesh." Okay, now there are two ways of seeing what Laban said, more than two, at least two ways of seeing what Laban says. The first one I want to say is, if he told him all that happened, then he told him, "I tricked my father, I stole the birthright," and what does Laban say? "You're a man after my own heart," is the way we would say it, right? "You're my bone and flesh." Because he didn't have to really tell him all that to prove that he was his relative, right? He could have given him a much shorter story to tell him he was his relative. But he tells him everything he did, and Laban, now, the commentators notice that Jacob kisses Rachel, but Laban kisses Jacob. Why doesn't Jacob kiss Laban? So two approaches to this. One is that Jacob doesn't like Laban. His heart's immediately drawn to Rachel. but his heart is not immediately drawn to Laban. And that's why it says that Laban embraces him and kissed him. Even though in theory, I suppose it's ambiguous, right? But it seems, since Laban is the last person mentioned, it seems like he does that. And second, according to Rashi, Laban is checking to see what he has with him. Have any jewels in his pockets? He kisses him to see if he has any gold in his teeth. That's exactly what Rashi says. And this is reinforced by, yes, I know. Well, you know, gold in your teeth presumably is, where is it? 32:11. Okay, if you go to, you don't have to go with me because I'll read the verse to you. But if you go to chapter 32, verse 11, what does Jacob say? Jacob says, oh God and God of my father, God of my Isaac, this is before he's about to meet Esau. I'm unworthy of all the kindness you so steadfastly shown your servant. With my staff alone, I crossed this Jordan. In other words, when Jacob first came to Laban, all he had was the staff that he walked with. That was it. And he must be telling the truth because it's stupid to lie to God about what you had, right? When you're about to ask him to save your life. So he didn't really have, you know, you can't hide jewels from God. That's all Jacob had. And he went to Laban penniless, which is an interesting question. Why was he given money when he left? Did he spend it along the way? Did he squander it? Did he lose it? But for whatever the issue is, he comes to Laban with nothing, and Laban quickly discovers that and realizes that this is someone he can take advantage of for two reasons. One is because he's alone, and second, because Laban knows who his family is, so his family's not going to come after him. It's very dangerous, especially in the ancient world, to take advantage of somebody if you don't know who their family is, because they might have a big family. They might come after you. They might resent it, but Jacob, he knows who Jacob's family is, and they're not going to cause him any trouble. Jacob is entirely at his disposal. And he's not a good guy. So, I mean, he's not the most evil guy. He doesn't plan to work Jacob for 20 years and kill him, but he's still family, after all. But he's family kind of the way, you know, he's mafioso family. That is, you know, you have to treat the person okay, but you can also exploit them. All right, so the theme of Jacob's loving Rachel, which is, it's a classic love story, not only in the sense that Jacob immediately falls in love with Rachel, but that Rachel dies young. Right, which is like, Eric Siegel could have written this up, if you remember Love Story, which is exactly the story. Falls in love with her and she dies young. But in a classic love story, of course, someone dying young is almost mandatory, and preferably both Romeo and Juliet. Right, if they both die young, it's a really great love story. But that's not going to work here, because really overriding the human love story is the divine plan. The divine love story, and Jacob has to produce the 12 tribes, and we have to see him into Egypt. But the initial moment of Jacob finding Rachel and kissing Rachel and breaking into tears, unless you really see Jacob very cynically, is very moving. And imagine, again, he's a young guy, and he's left home, and he has no one. He has no one. And he doesn't know what he's going to find in Haran, and the first thing he finds is this young, beautiful, sympathetic woman. So it's not unsurprising that Jacob, who is, I think it's fair to say, is an emotional and impressionable young man, as evidenced by the fact that he is scared, that he runs away, and he has this powerful dream, is moved by the sight of Rachel. Let's just spend a minute. We could spend a lot more time, but I remember that we did last year. We spent a lot of time on it, and I don't want to do that again. But let's just spend a minute on the dialogue of Jacob and the workers, and then we'll take questions and comments. So verse 4, Jacob says, "My friends, where are you from?" He doesn't know where he is, right? It's not, remember, it's the ancient world. There aren't big signs, "Welcome to Haran," with the mayor's picture right on it. You don't know where you are. You come to a place, there are no natural boundaries. They say, "We're from Haran." And then he says, "Do you know Laban, son of Nahor?" And they say, "Yes, we do." He continued, "Is he well?" And they answered, yes, he is, and there's his daughter Rachel coming with the flock. Now, why so much detail? One of the things that you see in the Hebrew more than the English is that the Hebrew is very clipped. They don't speak, right? They say, mecharan anachnu, two words. He says, hayadatam et Lavan ben Nachor, vayomru, and they, that's all Jacob speaking. They say, yadanu, we know him. So he says, hashalom lo, and they say, shalom. Vihine Rachel bito, and here's his daughter. And that's it, right there, uncommunicative, unfriendly, not what Jacob is used to. He's moved into an alien world, right, where people are not the same as the people that he knows. And he's clearly trying to engage them in some kind of conversation. They're completely uninterested. They're uninterested in him. They're uninterested in talking. And as soon as Rachel comes, they fob him off on Rachel. Here she is. You know, go talk to her. Leave us alone. Not only that, but he tries to do them seemingly a service, right, coming with the flock. He says it's broad daylight. Too soon to round up the animals, take them to the pasture. And the only time they talk is when they explain that they're under instructions. We can't until all the flock are rounded up. Then the stone is rolled off the mount of the water, and we water of the well, and we water the sheep. And here, too, there is a contrast between people who don't think for themselves, this is what we do, and this is our routine, and Jacob, who is highly individualistic, at least in the future, right? He's done having other people tell him what to do. His mother did that, and look where it ended up. He's now alone in Haran with no one there. And so from now on, with Lavan, for example, he's going to somewhat follow directions, but not entirely, and certainly the same thing is true for the rest of his life. Okay, and the only other thing I'll say is Jacob's kissing Rachel and breaking into tears is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen with Joseph. Remember, Rachel is Joseph's mother. Jacob is going to, again, come into difficulty through love, right? Because what's going to happen is he's going to love Joseph. And as a result, the other brothers are going to hate Joseph and sell Joseph into slavery. Love is a very ambiguous quality here. In fact, you know that in the story of Joseph, Joseph is loved by his father, gets put into slavery, and then Potiphar's wife tells him that she loves him. And according to the Midrash, the rabbis who pick up on this quality have Joseph saying to her, don't love me, because love hasn't proved to be helpful to me in the past, right? I'm not so interested in people loving me. It doesn't seem to work. So there is that theme threaded through, which is that human love is not unlike human love depicted in romantic movies. In the Bible, human love is a very double-edged, is a somewhat double-edged quality, right? It's a beautiful thing, but it has a destructive potential, as it does here, because after all, the reason that Jacob is out here is because Rebecca loves him, right? And love means favoritism, and any love means unlove, too, right? When you love one person, it means you don't love the other person, and that's picked up on here. Not necessarily true, I suppose, with parents and children, but nonetheless, it's very hard for any child to feel exactly equally loved. Right? Very hard. And that's certainly demonstrated in the story of Jacob and then the story of Joseph. Okay, so questions, comments? Yeah.
Well, there's perhaps another interpretation, which is that Rebecca, he didn't wind up here by accident. He wound up here because Rebecca sent him this way.
Right.
Because her brother was there.
Yes.
And so when he arrives there, he's just overwhelmed because he's made it. And then when he finds out that this is his Miss Rafa, he feels that much more comfortable and relieved. And so that's what his emotion is. And his kiss, which if it's love, it's certainly infatuation, because he doesn't even know.
Right.
So it's, you know, maybe this is naive, but he's arrived. He's home.
I think that's all true. I think it doesn't contradict necessarily what we said. But yeah, I think that there's probably a tremendous sense of relief that he found her, that he got to the right place. And also, here, I'll read you what Cass says, which is nice. Eros. Eros meaning passionate love, sexual love. There's no question that Eros opens the soul to someone and something beyond oneself. When we're in love, the whole world seems brighter and better. We become more attentive to the wondrous and the extraordinary. We recognize the presence of powers beyond our control. We feel gratitude for the existence of the beloved. In all these ways, among others, Eros may incline us to recognize and look toward the divine. So it may also be that Jacob feels there's a pattern in all this, because all of a sudden the world is working out and everything is great. Yeah.
I'm getting a picture of this scene here. Jacob comes upon three shepherds who are sitting around having coffee and cigarettes waiting for the senior shepherd to...
Yes, waiting for the boss.
Rachel approaches, and it's apparent to Jacob right away that she's a very important person, because when she gets there, they're going to roll back the stone and water all the flocks.
Well, he does. Whether they would have otherwise, I don't know. But they certainly all know who she is, and they all point her out. So it may also be that Jacob has this, which is why I think what you're hinting at, Jacob has this sense that he's been led to a good place, that Laban, you know, has some sway in this town. So, which would make sense, because we know that Jacob, that Rebecca comes from a conniving family. So, yeah.
Rebecca knows Laban.
Well, if you look at, when we analyze the story of Rebecca leaving Laban, it seems, yes, that Laban, with Eliezer, when he first comes, that Laban is materialistically oriented, put it that way. So, yeah, I think she did know. Yeah.
Wasn't the blessing for Jacob one of the blessings that he wouldn't serve anyone?
Yes. It depends what serve means. It doesn't mean that necessarily that it wouldn't work for someone. There are degrees of service. But that's part of the reason why Beno Jacob, and I don't know if you were here when we read his passage, says that the blessing was really not for Jacob personally, but for his descendants, although it didn't work for them either. But I also want to point out the similarity here if you look... It says, for those of you who can read the Hebrew, in verse 10, after he rolls back the stone, it says, Vayashk et tzon, and he waters the sheep. And then the very next, Vayishak, the same letters, Yaakov, right? Kissing and watering, the same letters. So there is, if you want to make a midrash on that, and I don't know if you do or not, but the kissing is an investment, right? It makes things grow. Just like watering. But there's an interesting, I just read this actually in a beautiful article by Rabbi Shochet. Eli Shochet wrote, I don't know if you know him, he was a rabbi, still is in the Valley, and a very scholarly rabbi, and he was writing an article about Hasidic traditions in a journal called Chakira. And at the end of it, he talks about an interpretation the Vilna Gaon wrote about a verse in Proverbs that the Torah is like water, and then the rabbis say what that means is that, you know, when you, just as you water the ground, what grows, if you invest yourself in Torah, what grows. And the Vilna Gaon says, and I wonder what prompted him to say this, other than the fact that he was a genius, off the charts, a genius, and always saw things that nobody else saw in the verses. He said, that's exactly right, that what grows in the ground depends on the ground you water. Sometimes you get flowers, sometimes you get weeds. Some people study Torah and get weeds. Some people study Torah and get flowers. All depends what the ground is and what you bring to it, right? Which is an extraordinary comment for somebody who spent his entire life studying Torah to say, but I guess he knew a lot of people who studied Torah, and some of them maybe he didn't like so much. Who knows? But so Jacob is watering here, but what he's going to get for watering, you know, will depend, obviously, on the quality of the waterer and the soil. Okay, yeah. Yes. Let me put it this way. I know a little bit about it, and there's much more research on it. Shai Cohen's done a lot of work on this. It was much later on, and it really happened probably in the rabbinic period, but not at all in the biblical period. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused. Who is Laban?
Okay, Laban is, who is, remember?
Jacob's uncle,
right, Rebecca's brother, okay? So his mother's brother, and that's why Marcia asked the question about his first cousin, because his kids are Jacob's first cousins, but in the Torah, you know, doesn't, right, there weren't enough people, and certainly not in your family, right? And consanguinity, which is the fancy English word for it, was not at all uncommon. Sorry?
So his daughter is Rachel?
His daughter is Rachel, yes.
He has two daughters.
Yep, Rachel and Leah.
I believe that what the Torah is trying to tell us, or the moral of the story, is what goes around comes around.
Well, yes, there's certainly, I mean, as we'll see, there's certainly a lot of, I mean, what Jacob does, and in many ways, and you'll see this particularly when Jacob and Rachel, when Leah and Rachel fool him, they, you know, the rabbis say explicitly, you know, substituting one sibling for the other. Sound familiar,
yeah.
Jacob? So that's certainly part of what happens to him, although it never comes around identically. You know, things, even recurrence is always with variations. That's what makes recurrence so interesting. That's why you get, you know, that's what evolution is all about. Right, you reproduce your genes, but a few things don't work quite the way they did in the last generation, and that's why, you know, your kids are not like you exactly. Sadly, they should be, right? If only they were like us. Yeah. Right. Yes.
The funny thing is that it looks like he really doesn't like Laban, because at the beginning he knows his name.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Do you know Laban?" But then after that he says, his mom's brother, his mother's brother, his mother's brother. He never mentions him as Laban anymore, because he really doesn't care for him.
It's possible. I certainly think, given their future history, that there's every evidence that he doesn't, that they don't get along. You know,
and she warned him also.
Right. Maybe she warns him. And the other interesting thing is, you know. Do you remember what Rachel said about how long he was going to stay there? She says, Yamim Achadim, right? You'll stay there for a few days. Look back in, I'm happy to read it to you. It's when she sends him away, she says, it's chapter 28. No, one second, where is it? No, it's chapter 27. She says, okay. Yeah, verse 44. Flee at once to Haran, to my brother's house. Stay with him a while. But a while in Hebrew is yamim achadim, which literally means single days. In other words, a few days. And that's exactly, by the way, the expression that is used. When Jacob works for 7 years, it says it seemed to him like a few days, which is a beautiful biblical echo. But it may be, I mean, maybe Rachel was saying that to make him feel better, because she didn't want to say to him, I'll never see you again. I mean, Rebecca was saying it to make him feel better. But it may also be that Jacob came here with the expectation that he was going home soon. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
So Jacob doesn't see his parents anymore?
No. Yeah. Yeah.
So earlier you began with the question about whether this is a love that would last. And it seems that clearly it does.
With Rachel it does.
Yes.
Yes. Right. Yes, he loves, right, Benjamin and Joseph are the children that he particularly loves, because that's true, that his memory and his love for Rachel is enduring. Of course, the interesting question is, what would his experience of Rachel have been had Rachel lived? He cherishes the memory of the wife whom he loved, the first person whom he loved, who dies. And it's impossible to know. I mean, there are models. There aren't that many models where you see inside a marriage in the Bible in general, and the ones that are generally not, you know, like you see inside David's marriage, but not to its credit particularly, at least not with Michal. He does a little better with Bathsheba, but the beginning is rocky. So anyway, it's an interesting thought. I mean, a lot of it you have to turn to the Midrash, you have to turn to the rabbis, because the Bible doesn't give you that much information. It just doesn't. Any other? What's that? Yes. Well, here's what I would say about it, is that you don't know the truth either about yourself or your partner until you get married. I think that a lot of people try to be honest, but nobody knows what it's like to be married without being married. So you actually discover together what the truths of your character are. And I think that it's also the case that the truths of your character are in part the truths of your character under the influence of the other person whom you're with, which is why you're not always the same person in marriage 2 or marriage 3 that you are in marriage 1, better or worse, whatever. Right? Although you know Samuel Johnson's famous line that a second marriage is the triumph of hope over experience. For what it's worth. But that's, I think that that's part of the, I actually think that that's part of the story here, is that people shape themselves in part in terms of their relationships, not only marriage, but in terms of their relationships. And that's why when people say, for example, what kind of parents they're going to be, they say that before they know what kind of kids they're going to have. And the kind of parent you're going to be depends on what your child is like, because again, it's a relational term, parent. No parent without a child. You don't live, you know, no wife without husband, husband without wife. And so what Jacob is going to be will depend in part on what Leah and Rachel are, and vice versa. But as long as we're on this and we're mentioning quotes about such things, Chekhov, the great Russian, really the short story writer and playwright, said, "If you wish to be lonely, marry." Now, what was behind that? Right, but what was behind that? Behind that was exactly what I read in the opening poems, which is it's the gap between expectation and reality. Right? It's the assumption of somebody else can, in fact, climb inside my soul. And then the reality of what it is to live with another human being. Right? That's what he was saying. So it is, like all such aphorisms, it's true except when it isn't. There is no such thing that is the final truth on human nature, which is why you have to have more than one story and more than one truth. But still, I don't know whether Chekhov was married, but that would be an interesting. But I will tell you this: we like Chekhov not only because he was one of the greatest writers who ever lived, but also because he had a nice correspondence at the end of his life with Sholem Aleichem and tried to place some of Sholem Aleichem's stories in Russian periodicals, which for a Russian who was not Jewish, he was also supposed to be he was a doctor by profession. He's supposed to be an extraordinarily kind and decent man. Anyway. All right. He also said there is more true piety in clean water than there is in all the prayers of priests, which is what a doctor would say, right? Because he saw people who died all the time of lack of food and so on. He was an interesting man, Chekhov. Okay, enough with Chekhov. All right, the only other point that I want to make is that in this story, so far, Rachel is a cipher. She is acted upon, but we don't know what her experience is of all of this, except in as much as we can imagine it. And my guess is that, in part, Rachel has the same experience that her mother, her aunt did, Rebecca, which is, you know, a literary critic once said there are only two stories. And all stories can be resolved into one of these two plots. Either someone goes on a journey, right? And the journey can be internal, it can be a literal journey, or a stranger comes to town. Those are the only two stories. And any story that you have follows one or the other. And for Rebecca, what happened was a stranger came to town. Eliezer came. And it was the beginning of her story. And she, because she was an enterprising and smart and capable person, she immediately saw that Eliezer was her chance. And remember, she says to her family, bye, right? They said, well, we'll stay here for a few days and so on. She goes, no, I'm leaving this morning. I'll see you later, because she knew this was her chance to live. So Rachel, presumably, who probably goes to the same place every day and speaks with these, you know, monosyllabic shepherds and can't relate to them, all of a sudden, there's Jacob, who kisses and weeps and is a stranger. So my guess is that Rachel's experience was like Rebecca's experience, which is, this is my chance actually to have a life. But we don't know that for sure, although the fact that she marries Jacob suggests it. I don't know how much choice she has in such a thing. Yeah.
I have the echo of something in prayer that says, don't be led astray by your heart.
Yes. Lo taturu acharei levavchem. It's in the Shema. Right.
Right.
Yes.
And
I'm just curious. V'acharei enechem, and after your eyes.
Right.
So this goes back to the issue that I said before about what Chekhov said about, you know, if you wish to be lonely, marry, but that's only part of the truth. So this goes back to what Oscar Wilde said, that a deep truth is something the opposite of which is also a deep truth. And it is a deep truth not to be led astray by your heart or by your eyes, except when it is a deep truth to be led by your heart and by your eyes, right? And the same Torah that says don't be led astray by your heart also talks about, you know, how your heart speaks to you about God, or you should put these words on your heart. Actually, the very same prayer talks about that. So I think that the admonition there is, when the world of appearances differs with God's word, don't be led astray by the world of appearances. And the connection that most commentators make is that that's taturu, that same word in the Shema, is the word that's used when the spies scout out the land. So they see the land only superficially, right, as a place where there are giants that are going to kill us. This is in the book of Numbers. And they come back and they tell Moses, we can't conquer the land. But in fact, that's because they were led astray by their eyes and they didn't trust God. Remember that the greatest, in the Jewish tradition, the greatest reality is that which you can't see. So if you only believe in that which you can see, you're led astray by your eyes, because God is intangible. One and two, and then I think we have to go ahead.
Maybe your last sentence presupposes the answer to this question, but you talked about how only in the case of David did the Bible really delve into
extended, right.
Speculate for us, if you would, why in the case of Jacob or other relationships, the Bible treats it so superficially and doesn't discuss it anymore.
Because I would say, in general, it's the Bible's way to give you scattered comments and hints about every relationship, and you have to construct it between parents and children. It's not a novel. It doesn't work like a novel. We have the Akedah, which is between Abraham and Isaac when he takes him up to the mountain. It's very cryptic what happens between the two of them. There are only a couple of words. And you have to figure out from those couple of words what the story is. And one of the things that makes Bible study so fascinating, and we see again and again in this class, is because it's so tantalizingly brief in its descriptions, we have to fill in, both from our own experience and from the tradition of commentary, what that really means. Whereas if it were written like a novel, the novelist tells you sometimes what you're supposed to think about what you just saw. But the Bible rarely editorializes. It presents you with a very brief sketch of the facts, and then you have to figure this out. That's why. So if you think that Jacob, I mean, you can read what Jacob is like. If you think that Jacob is honest, then you've just seen him fall in love. If you think he's cynical, then he's trying to make a living off Laban. But the Bible doesn't tell you. So, yeah. Later on, we will see exchanges between Rachel and Leah. Yes, and those are actually going to be quite interesting because Leah is unloved but fruitful. Rachel is fruitless?
Barren.
I was going to say fruitless, right? That's like a Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks says that about Onan. He was fruitless and subtracted. So he was supposed to be fruitful and multiply. But so Rachel is barren, but loved. So, but we may get to that next time, but we'll get to it soon. Yeah.
She was the first female shepherdess that we see in the Bible.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Are there other examples of women
being shepherds? Yes, Deborah.
Zipporah?
Zipporah, that's right, because Moses has a repetition of this. There are other examples. I guess that must be a job that a woman would have in the ancient world. There is, you know, I have a book on my shelf that I've just glanced at. It's called something like, you know, Jobs in the Bible. It talks about what people did to make a living in the time of the Bible. I'll have to take a look and see if it says anything about women. Yeah.
I wonder how important is love in the eyes of God? Because I don't know if there's any mention that God loved people.
There is.
Is there actual when?
V'ahavti etchem, amar Adonai. God says in Malachi, I have loved you, says God. What? In Malachi, in the prophet Malachi. But it's also in the book of Devarim. It's not that God says that I loved your ancestors, not because you're such a large people. In fact, you're a small people, but I loved your ancestors. So it is there in the Torah. It's not mentioned often. There are also images in Jeremiah. God talks about how you followed me through the wilderness like a bride, right? But how important is love? I would say, I think that the predominant Jewish view, which I hold and is not the American view, that is, love is not an emotion, it is an enacted emotion. Love that doesn't act lovingly is not love. It's something else. It's a powerful feeling, but it's not love, right? Judaism doesn't actually hold the romantic view that obsession, for example, is love. If it treats the obsessed badly. So in that sense, there is mention of love a couple of times between people, but very rarely in the Bible. But it does happen a couple of times. So I don't know how important is love. I think that's, you know. I'll close with one question, and then I'll make a comment about love, and then we'll wrap it up. Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
In that way,
right.
You can't say self.
Yep.
Selfhood.
Right. I think that that's true. That love is not, love is something that has to be, love, the way that, in The Road Less Traveled, M. Scott Peck talks about love as being an act of will. And I don't know if an act of will is exactly right, but I would say loving is more, yes, enacted or loving is in some ways better than love. I just want to close by saying this. There's a big, this is just a theory, nobody knows, but it's a brilliant theory and it's interesting to think about. There is one book of the Bible that is all about love. The Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon. It's a love poem. It's an erotic love poem. In some places explicit, right? Why is it in the Bible? That's the question, because it is clearly an erotic love poem between a man and a woman, right? The rabbis interpret it as between God and Israel, and the church later interprets it as between God and the church. And Marvin Pope, who is a biblical scholar, he did the Anchor Bible on the Song of Songs. And the Song of Songs is a very small book, but it's a really thick volume, and it's all because of all these allegories that people put on the Song of Songs over the years, which begs the question, if it's clearly not about that, how did it get in there? And in fact, Rabbi Akiva is the one who's responsible for it. Because he was the one who said it's the Holy of Holies. In other words, he called it a holier book than other books of the Bible, and he was Rabbi Akiva. But Gerson Cohen, about 30 years ago, wrote a very interesting essay where he proposes a theory. It may be true, it may not be true. He said, basically what happened was the rabbi's experience of God was an experience of love. That was how they experienced God and how they thought of God. And they looked in the Bible and they didn't find enough that expressed that experience. And the rabbis thought the Bible must express the experience, the central experience of God that they had, which was love. So they knew that the Song of Songs must be about that, because it's not possible that the Bible didn't express what they understood to be the central experience of love. So they put it in there because that was what they knew the Bible must talk about, because their experience of God was one of love, and there wasn't enough in here to express it. So he may be right, he may be wrong, but it's interesting how he reads the way the rabbi saw the Bible, and the fact that the Bible doesn't have as many expressions of love. It may have acts of love, but not as many expressions of love as you would think. There is a midrash that says that the Torah opens and closes with deeds of loving kindness. The first thing that God does for human beings is he makes clothes for Adam and Eve, and the last thing he does is bury Moses. So both of those are considered acts of loving kindness. So it depends, you know, how you read the book. All right, see you next week. Thanks.